This episode of Rhodey Radio is brought to you by free online library card applications. Did you know that Rhode Island library cards expire every 3 years to ensure that your account information is up to date? If your library card is expiring soon, you can renew it easily online. Don't have a library card? You can apply for a library card online too. Visit oslri.org to renew or apply for a library card today.
You're listening to Rhodey Radio, Rhode Island Library Radio Online. Hi there, Dave Bartos here, Coordinator of Adult Services at the Cranston Public Library and Rhodey Radio team member. For today's episode, I'm talking with Carla Pansiera, author of Barnflower, a Rhode Island farm memoir. Carla was born in Westerly, Rhode Island, and raised on her family's dairy farm. She graduated from the University of New Hampshire with a BA in English, and has a graduate degree in poetry from Boston University. In addition to Barnflower, she has published two collections of poetry, One of the Similores from Cider Press, and No Day, No Dusk, No Love from Bordighera, and a collection of short stories, Bewildered, which received the 2013 Grace Paley Short Fiction Award from the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. Her short stories have appeared in the New England Review, The Clackamas Review, Slice, and other magazines. Her short story, The Kind of People Who Look at Art, was chosen by Juno Diaz as a distinguished story in Best American Short Stories for 2017. With Barnflower, Carla returns to her childhood, where she spent years with her father and his famous herd traveling from county fair to county fair and answering the same questions. Is that Aldo Pansiera? And are you Aldo's daughter? This memory book is based on the real man and his very real effort to make a living at what he loved, and a testament to the bond between a father and a daughter and their love for the kind of life they shared, a kind of life that is both critical and a vanishing part of our history. I caught up with Carla at the Washington County Fair in Richmond, Rhode Island on August 17, 2023, where she gave me a behind-the-scenes tour of the livestock shows and what's going on beyond the concession stands and carnival rides. Then we went to the Clark Memorial Library to talk more about her book. You'll know I'm at the fair when I start speaking in hushed tones.
Hello.
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 Hi,
Carla. Lovely to see you.
Well, very nice to meet you.
Yes.
Welcome to the fair.
Yeah, this is lovely.
Okay.
I've never been here. I grew up going to the Canfield Fair, which is in Canfield, Ohio, which is where I grew up. So it's bringing back all the memories.
Well, this one hasn't changed since I showed here 50 years ago.
Fantastic.
All right, so Papa, I'm going to leave this with you. There's more books under the table. I have more in the car, but I don't know if anybody comes by. Well, we're just going to walk around here, and I'll tell you before we leave. Okay, so...
Yeah, so you were talking about how it hasn't changed much since you showed here.
So, yeah, the fairgrounds have not changed. The way it works for 4-H kids is your parents drop you off the night before the fair starts with your cows, and they say goodbye.
Okay.
And you are with all kids your own age for however long the fair is.
Wow.
And the only time you see your parents is when they come to watch you in the ring. And other than that, you're kind of on your own.
Wow, it's almost like summer camp then,
You know, that is the... And it's funny that you made that analogy because I never went to summer camp, overnight camp.
Yeah.
But I've heard about the bonding experiences and then how you get home and you're sort of homesick for that experience. And that is exactly what it is.
Wow.
So, because you have all these kids together at the same time, and you know, and we are responsible because we have to care for live animals.
Of course.
And that's our first responsibility here.
Yeah.
But we're also kids, so
yes.
You know, we got free ride tickets from the
carnies. I was gonna say.
We had Dell's Lemonade before anybody knew what Dell's Lemonade was.
Nice.
You know, and I do recognize all of the different food booths and all of the different, you know, things that we would try to save our money to buy.
Yeah.
This livestock area is pretty much the same. Yeah, and it's great because if today especially, one of the things I've noticed is when I was showing, there were both young people showing, like our age, 4-H,
yeah.
but then our parents were also showing, there were older people showing. Today, I would say 80% of the people who have been in the ring have been young people.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful to see because there aren't a lot of, there's three working dairy farms in Rhode Island right now.
Mm-hmm.
And when I grew up, there were four working dairy farms in my town.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
So I know it's a small state, but people, so many people here have tried to farm and have come from farms where they were milking, and they just can't sustain that anymore.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see that they still have their children connected in some way.
Doing that.
To that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
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 And I think this is a beautiful, I'm from Ohio originally, and like this is just wonderful. Like, how Rhode Island is such a microcosm. It's like yeah. I drove here from Cranston, which yeah. is the city, and then now I'm in the farm. And I could drive another 20 minutes and I'd be at the seashore.
Yes.
And, you know, in Ohio, you couldn't get that. It was just, I lived in the farm.
Yeah.
And that was about it. There was a city an hour away, but...
Yeah, yeah, it's
you know,
very different.
So this is, it's really great to have all these things and to sustain all of these things,
yes.
right?
And as a friend of mine said, who's been coming every year, this I've had huge gaps between my visits. She said to me, you're going to recognize the names. It's just a couple generations later.
Yeah.
And she's right.
You yeah.
know, she's here with her grandchildren. And we, you know, we were here as kids together. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I can show you. I don't know. You want to see the cows?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're all different breeds here today. There
okay.
are six major breeds of dairy cows. My, the kind of cow I show is a black and white one.
Okay.
Right there. That's a Holstein. They make up more of the dairy cows than any in the country because they milk the most.
Okay.
So, and you know, all of these boxes that you see here, they're all kids' boxes. They have their all their supplies in them, their halters and their sprays and their shampoo and all that kind of stuff. And
okay.
Rhode Island has, you have to have a specific box with a specific color if you're a 4-H member.
Okay. I'm curious because you said it's like a week-long affair. You get dropped off. Do you do multiple fairs or did you do multiple fairs this
yeah.
summer?
Yeah, well, so last night all the young kids showed in a class called showmanship. And showmanship is all about how you control your animal, how you present your animal to the judge, mm-hmm. how clean your animal is and fit. They have to be clipped a special way. Their hooves have to be clean, their ears, all of that. So that went on last night for all different age groups.
Okay.
Kids as young as 5 years old were in the ring.
Wow,
they're so
that's
cute.
Awesome.
So cute.
Yeah.
And then today we have, these are confirmation classes. So what the judge is looking at today is a cow has to have a certain kind of a body to produce a lot of milk
okay.
for a long period of time. So there are things that they look for. And so that is why you see some adults showing today too, because
okay.
they're just judging the cow herself. Is this a cow you would want in your herd to keep
okay.
breeding future generations?
And I assume that's the one of the reasons for the showing and the fair is exactly that.
Exactly, yes.
For breeding and maintaining dairy herds. Okay.
Right. So you would, because it's partly advertising for your own farm.
Yeah.
But now it's a lot of advertising for bulls as well.
Okay.
Because, you know, most of the cows you see here, in fact, I'm going to say probably all of them were conceived via artificial insemination.
Okay.
And those bulls are things you pick out of a catalog, right?
Okay.
So,
yeah, yeah.
Online. So if you go to a fair and you see these animals that you like, you'll go and get that bull to try to work in your herd.
Okay.
So, and you know, you obviously can, people buy and sell the cows all the time as well. They now take cows and flush their embryos. If you get a championship cow,
okay.
you flush her embryos out and you can get several different, people will come and say, oh, I want an embryo from that cow. You know, they won't even buy a calf. They just
wow.
buy her embryo and fertilize it.
And then.
So it's very genetic.
Wow.
All of the genetics and fertility stuff that human beings go through were practiced first on cows because cows have the same gestation period. They have a 9-month
okay.
gestation.
Oh, wow.
So they had test tube babies long before we did.
Wow,
and
that's
yeah.
fascinating. I never would have known that.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long has that been going on, in
well,
other words?
Artificial insemination, I think, started in the, if I'm not wrong, in the late 40s.
Okay, wow, yeah, yeah.
And one of the issues was they couldn't transport the semen very far because they didn't know how to store it.
Okay.
Once they found liquid nitrogen in, say, the early 60s, then, you know, you could raise a bull in Rhode Island and his offspring could be born in California.
Wow.
They could be
yeah.
born in Europe, whatever. And then as far as the embryo transplants in cows, I don't know when the first one started, but we bought an embryo in probably 1989.
Okay.
You know, and by then it was
right.
well established.
It was just the thing that you did. Yeah,
yeah.
absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was started with, you know, farmers who had a lot of money, a lot of businessmen who then have farms sort of on the side. Mm. That's kind of where it started because you really needed money. But now, I mean, I was with a friend yesterday and he goes every year and he buys two embryos to, you know, breed, right. for, you know, for the next
year. It's part of the, like, workflow,
yeah,
in other words.
And just, you know, anybody here can probably go buy an embryo if they wanted
sure.
to. So these are beef cows. And they're also here. And then, so you asked what we did all week, I think.
Yeah.
So we would have the showmanship shows, we'd have the breed show, and then on Friday they had a special 4-H show. And then all the other cows go home, and some of the 4-H kids keep their cows here, so when people come to the fair, they can see animals.
Okay.
And we can answer questions about them. And so again, it's partly for entertainment, but again, we want people to know about farming and what's
right.
happening. Get them
right,
out.
Keep that culture alive. So, oh, this is, I mean, it's fantastic, and I think being a not farm kid,
yeah.
and knowing the fair as being like the Midway and the rides,
yes.
and you know, like the food, like that was my entrance into going to fair. But like, there's so much going on here that is the true purpose. It's just really, really.
Well, they are all agricultural fairs. That's the
yes.
call. But to get everybody in, you bring things that most people want to see. But that's why. Again, you see all of these animals, they're judged, but they stay here for days because, you know, we want people to interact with them. We want
yeah.
people to see where their food comes from. And, you know, you're looking at small farmers, like Pam said, these cows are very well cared for. These cows still go out to pasture. A lot of the milk that you buy in the supermarket, those cows have never stepped foot in on a pasture.
Yeah.
They don't graze. And cows love to graze. When they go out the first nice day of the year, they run and their tails go up in the air and they gallop. And it's clear. They express joy.
Yes.
And in so many farms now, they never get out of a stanchion, they never get out of a barn.
Hmm.
But not these cows that you're seeing
yeah.
today.
And you were talking about the number of family farms in Rhode Island and how it's changed from when you were coming up, and I would assume it's the economics that have made that change.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is about passion. You have to want to do it, because when you have a dairy farm, you milk twice a day, every day.
Yep.
So on our dairy farm, we milk 8 hours a day was just milking.
Yeah.
And then there was everything else. And if you don't really get paid for that, you
right.
can't pay. So what most farmers have done now that to stay in business is they've diversified. So they might have beef cows as well. They might have corn mazes. When you see those corn mazes
yep.
by dairy farms, they're trying to keep dairy farms in business.
Yeah.
You know, they might sell, they have woodlots, they have vegetables or pumpkin patches or whatever. We did
right.
not do that as a dairy farm. We just had cows. We couldn't
right.
do anything else. We were too busy with that, you know. But we lost our farm. Kids still have fun at fairs.
Yes.
And so now, what they're doing now when they're, this is the end of the day, these are ash years. These are red and white cows from Scotland. Rhode Island is known for the Ashiers of breeds. We've had really good Ashier breeders over the years. Like the Cottrell Homestead in West Kingston, Rhode Island has been around for over 100 years. They still have Ashiers. They don't milk them anymore, but they have calves and heifers.
Mm-hmm.
You can see like how gentle the cows are. You know, they weigh upwards of 1,500 pounds, but you can put them on a lead like that and they'll do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
They're supposed to keep their heads up nice and tall like that, so they
okay.
look nice and tall. They stop them a certain way, where the legs are always placed to make them look nice and square. You know, we get judges from all over the country. To be a cattle judge, you have to go through a whole series of classes and tests and qualifications. And you get prize money.
Right.
You get ribbons, you get hat. Today they're giving out caps, which is really cool.
Yeah.
I got a lot of useless trophies. The first one is always thrilling, and then after that,
right.
like, what am I going to do with all these?
Right.
So, a baseball cap. I've been...
Right, something practical.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Makes me think of, what is the golf where they get a jacket?
Oh, right? Yeah, the Masters.
Right? And
yeah.
it's like, you win that, and then you have a jacket, and it's like, that's a practical
right.
thing. You wear a jacket.
Or a big, like, Super Bowl ring.
Yes. That's what it should be.
Yeah. So another difference between when I showed and now is, when I showed, again, I showed Holsteins, the black and white ones, Wednesday at the fair, all day was the Holstein show. All day was black and white cows.
Okay.
And the next day was the Ashier show, these cows, all day with the Ashiers. Now, the good news is we have Guernseys, Jerseys, Brown Swiss, and Milking Shorthorn also showing. But the bad news is we don't have enough of any breed to do a breed show. So they kind of mix them all in. So this has been a really long day.
Yeah.
They started showing at 10, and, you know, every breed comes in. There are different age group classes, and so you have to go through these six different breeds and all of their breed classes and all the championships, and but that's how you have to do it when you just don't have enough animals to compete. When you go to, if you go to the, something big like the Eastern States Exposition, the Big E,
okay,
they'll have a full day of breeds. So
right.
Brown Swiss has their whole day, and Holsteins have their whole day, and then 4-H has a separate day. You can see, like, how much work there is involved.
Yeah.
These cows are body clipped. They have no hair. Their hair is clipped on their bodies. But it's left on their bellies. And because you want a cow to appear that, that she has a bunch, she has a lot of depth. Because the more food she can eat, the more milk she can produce.
Okay.
So you want her to look like she's got a, a barrel of a body.
Yeah.
That's different. When I was a kid, we couldn't clip them. We had to blanket them and make sure they shed out their hair and they look good. But a little easier. You could see that you want the cow to have a really straight top line.
Okay.
So they tease up all that hair along their spine and they spray it. And if you touch it, it's like serious hair gel.
Oh, wow. You know? I never would have guessed.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I mean, maybe something else people see on TV more often is like a dog breed show.
Yes.
There's like, this is this kind of cow and these are the standards.
Right.
For judging, yeah.
And there are people who can do this professionally.
Yeah.
And there are people who do a really good job fitting their cows. And there are other people who don't do such a good job fitting their cows. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and at a small fair like this, it's not such a huge deal. But at one of the big fairs, you know, it could be the difference for you.
Yeah.
If the cow's not fit right, she doesn't look as good as the cow next to her. And that's not a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, here, this one has the ribbon on.
Yeah. So the blue's the first place ribbon.
Yeah.
And she's now waiting to go in. Once you get first place in your classes at the end, all the first place and second place winners go in for a champion and reserve championship.
Okay.
Of the breed. But it's a nice cool day. A lot of times when we come to these fairs, I've never shown on a cool day. Always been hot. And obviously there's no shade out there.
Right.
Cows like cool weather. They don't like the heat.
Yeah.
They don't milk well in the heat. So it's a long day for them. They're not, they like to be with their herds.
Yes.
They like their own barns. That's why you see them.
Just like any of us, right?
Right.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You see them finally lay down. It's like, I'm done.
Yes.
I've been standing and I'm holding 1,500 pounds here. I need to lay down for a little bit. So. And they also wear, when you bring a cow into the ring, she has to have a leather halter on. But normally if you just, she's tied somewhere, she's going to have a rope halter. So you have to have, you know, they have to have special gear.
Yeah, and really like right here in the ring to describe it for listeners, like it's all ages of people showing cows right now.
Yes.
Which is really, like you said, it's really neat to see people continuing this, you know, to be passing on this knowledge.
And you missed the five-year-olds.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
So.
I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine if I have a six-year-old and like just imagining him leading a cow.
Well, they had very small calves.
Yeah.
But
yeah, but still.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about my six-year-old, like, he could do with a little bit of that responsibility.
Yeah. Well, you know,
you know
what?
Yeah.
What when you work around large animals and you learn to control them, you do gain a certain confidence and competency.
Yeah.
That's one of those skills. Like, I know a lot about cows, and I don't have to use those skills in my normal life.
Right.
But I do think it made us more confident kids.
Yeah.
Because we could, it didn't, we weren't intimidated by any, we, you know, I talked about this with a friend of mine yesterday. We really could do anything you asked us to do.
Yeah.
You said, move that truck, and we were 14 years old. We could move that truck.
Right.
You know, and if you said, this cow has to have medicine, she's going to have a shot, she's got to have a bolus, we did that. We didn't call a vet. We don't, couldn't, I mean, we called vets only in emergencies. We could deal with a lot of things on our own.
Right.
It just is a different world, but that, you don't think about it, you just go, oh, okay.
It's that kind of like, it has to get done. I'm here, I'm going to do it, right?
Yeah. Right, and I think our parents weren't worried that we wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I was a tiny kid, like a skinny kid, and we had the bags of grain weighed 50 pounds.
Yeah.
And I fed the calves in the afternoon, and if the grain was empty, I had to go get the bag of grain. I didn't call my dad.
Right.
I was like, okay, I didn't know how much a bag of grain weighed.
Exactly.
I just picked it up, you know?
You knew you needed to pick it up and move it to a place. Yeah, yeah.
So...
And then you found out it was a 50-pound bag of grain. You're
much
like, well.
Later in my life, and I was thinking, I probably didn't weigh 50 pounds when I picked it up. But,
exactly.
You know, I needed more grain.
Right.
God forbid I stopped my father and whatever he was doing and asked for help. He would have been a little impatient with me. So just went and got it. And I would have had to wait, and I wanted to go inside and do my homework or watch cartoons or something. I didn't want to be out in the barn for another hour waiting for my dad. So.
Right.
They do work together, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they compete against one another, but you learn so much from one another when you're in 4-H. You just, I saw one of my friends yesterday. I haven't seen him in probably 25 years. We were together 5.5 hours, and we never ran out of things to talk about. It was just so great to see him. And
yeah.
We also knew all of our families. Like, we knew everybody's parents, and we interacted all the time with everybody's parents.
Yeah.
And all of our parents knew each other because they were here all the time. You know,
yeah.
I mean, when they came for shows or we did fundraisers or we did field trips or something like that. Our parents were very involved in that, and they knew each other as professionals. Like, people came to our farm and bought calves from us. And,
right.
You know, my dad was one of the people who established 4-H in Rhode Island, so he was always very into helping out youth. We would go to different farms. They would have us there to judge their cows or clip their cows or practice on their herds. So we just had an intimate understanding of all the other farms and how they were run. And this is such a tiny state. There was not a farm that we really didn't have access to, or a farm family. So it was great.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and that community, that sense of community.
Right.
And, you know, that it's, again, it's continuing with the younger generations here. It's continuing with you as you run into people. Like, it's like, it feels like that family reunion atmosphere.
Right.
Like, here we're all at the fair again. And, you know, just seeing each other and doing this thing that we love together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's competition, but that's almost secondary. Or it's almost like it's the cow that's participating, that's competing, and you're escorting the cow, right?
And we know. Yes. I mean, if you've been in the ring a lot, you know that cow's going to beat me.
Yes.
it's not a secret. My dad had such an eye for cows. So when you show at the Springfield Fair, there might be 45 cows waiting outside the ring to go in for, say, the 4-year-old class.
Yeah.
I'd be standing out there with my cow, and my dad would go, "He's going to beat you. She's going to beat you. That cow's going to..." I'm like, "Are you kidding me? You already placed the class. Why should I even go in?"
Right.
You know, you just know that, but you're out there to be part of something.
You're out there to do the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's more important.
And you worked all year on it. And, you know, this is not what farming is.
Yes.
This is like the prom.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Right.
The prom is in high school.
Right.
High school's a lot of drudgery and work and dealing with drama. But fair day, everybody gets pretty, and everybody's out here showing their best thing, and that feels like a relief, too. It's just a nice break.
Yeah.
And it does fill you with some energy to go home and do the real work of farming, to come here and see that everybody else has a stake in it, too.
Yeah.
So I talk about this in the book a lot, how, you know, some people don't have a stake in what they do for a living.
Mm.
And some people don't even have a stake in their farms, so... You know, these big conglomerates, you milk 3,000 cows a day.
Yeah.
You don't have a stake in an individual cow the way these people do.
Sure.
And it meant something to us that we were producing good cattle, because that's the way that we fed our families and we preserved our land. So you couldn't shirk work, you couldn't do a second class job, because there was something at stake. And, you know, and these people still feel it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe even more acutely, because there are so few farms left.
Right.
And even I heard today one of the ones that's up and running right now may not be running much longer. Mm. So
yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah. And then what happens to that land? I love that some families, even though they don't milk anymore, they preserve their land.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do that, that's a whole separate issue that happens.
Yeah.
You know? Whether it's development, like my property is 76 houses and a Home Depot. It's not pretty anymore.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but if we wanted to head out and do a little sit down at the library, I'm just going to hit stop. So just to say on air, you know, I really appreciate the walk through the fair. That was a wonderful experience, and I appreciate having had it.
Yeah, I was happy to host you.
Yes.
Well, I think everybody should have a host through the fair, especially the livestock section.
Yeah, somebody to really let you know what you're seeing, because otherwise I would just say, oh, cow, that's really nice. But there's a lot to see, so that was wonderful.
Yeah, I think it is. It is partly about passion.
Yeah.
It's partly about history, and it's important to know where your food comes from.
Yes. Yeah, that reminds me of a story. My sister-in-law and her family do a meat CSA. And so a long time ago when their kid was like 5 or 6, they actually got to go to the farm and get a tour of the farm there and like see where their food comes from, as you just said. And this little 5-year-old was hugging a pig, and her husband were like, oh no, like what if she doesn't know? And then they leaned in and she's going, thank you for being my bacon. And it's like, okay, I think she knows. So yeah, that's, I mean, everything comes from somewhere and we're a part of it, I think is really what that comes down to. And it's good to be reminded of that.
Right. I mean, when I was growing up, we culled our cows, and we did once a year or so, we would send one to, you know, the butcher. Mm-hmm. So we always knew the name of our steak. We knew what we were eating. I don't eat meat anymore.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because I don't know where it comes from. So it makes a difference.
Well, let's turn to your book. So you've written Barnflower, which is a farm memoir. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us what led you to write a memoir about growing up on a farm? What was the germ of an idea there?
It was definitely a germ of an idea. And the reason I wrote a memoir is because I was really trying to write fiction. That's my first love. I had joined a writing group and I was trying to write short stories and I was really struggling. And I went to the University of New Hampshire as an undergraduate. And once a week in both freshman comp and sophomore composition, we had to write a 5-page essay.
Wow.
And so it became this genre that was a security blanket for me. I knew I could bang out something nonfiction pretty quickly.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, we have this cow. Her name was Darcy. Darcy had been loaned out to a 4-H'er so that he could show her at a fair like Washington County, where we just were. And at 2 years old, when she had her first calf and she started milking, he couldn't milk her. So she came back to our farm for us to milk, and he got to keep her calf as his next 4-H project.
Okay.
But Darcy didn't want to be home, so she broke through fences again and again and again. And I thought she was breaking through fences because the 4-H'er who had raised her was absolutely beautiful. And I was 12 and he was 16 and I had a crush.
Yeah.
And years later, I realized she was trying to get back to her calf.
Okay.
So I thought, well, I can tell the story. I can't write a piece of fiction, but maybe I could tell this story of Darcy. And when I did that, I had a little piece of paper beside my computer, and I thought, well, if I could tell a story of Darcy, I could tell a story about 29, and then there was Penny, then there was Kitty, and all these farm. I hadn't thought about actually mining the farm stories.
Okay.
And so that's how it started.
Wow, that's fantastic. And then you've put it all together in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the beginning, I thought there would be chapters dedicated to different cows. And I'd never seen that before. And I thought, well, that would be kind of fun. And I actually, my husband is also a writer. And when I get stuck in a project, he always says to me, remember, there's supposed to be joy involved in this. And I do need a reminder of that. And I was really looking forward to writing the pieces. And by the time I sat down to write Darcy, you know, my dad had been dead for probably 10 years. Mm-hmm. The farm had been gone for a little bit longer than that. And I realized I could go back there.
Yeah.
And that was magical. And the more I wrote, the more the stories became not about the cows, but about the life and especially about my relationship with my dad.
Yeah.
And then it did take me 30 years to write the book, but I didn't care. Because every time I sat back down to it, I was back with him and I could hear his voice and I was in that place that I love so much. So it was, at the end, it was kind of hard to let it go. But I never intended it to be the kind of book it is. I'm happy that it is the book it is. But I guess I didn't have a fully, completely thought out plan.
Do you mind talking a little bit about your father? I know it ends up being about your family and about your relationship with your father. So
can you
talk a little bit about him?
Yeah. So my dad, his name is Aldo Pansiera. He grew up in Westerly. His family, my grandfather and his brother and my grandmother and her sister, they were two married couples from the Dolomite region of Italy. They bought a farm in 1911. And in those days, they would have what we call grade animals. So they didn't have papers or registrations. We didn't know their bloodlines. And they ran a dairy. They ran Pansiera's Dairy. And my dad went to World War II. He was in the Army Air Corps, and he stationed the bombers that flew missions. He
when he was there, he thought, I want to go back and farm and I want purebred Holsteins. So we had 100 acres, very rocky, swampy acres. Mm-hmm. We were not a wealthy family. And he had this idea that seemed outlandish to his parents. We already had animals. Why would he want supposedly better animals? Mm-hmm. And so he did start buying purebred cattle, and he wanted to buy this one cow. Her name was Gay, and he went to a sale to purchase her. And Gay sold for $1,320 or $1,350, and my father didn't have that kind of money.
Yeah.
So a couple of years later, he was touring farms. He was looking for some calves to consign to a sale for one of the Holstein associations at the time. And Gay had just had a bull calf, and it was a scrawny, scraggly calf. And the person who was supposed to buy the calf didn't want the calf. And so my dad's like, well, I'll take this calf because he loved her dam. And he bought an interest. And you would buy an interest in a bull. You couldn't afford to buy the whole bull outright. And that bull became, the bull's name was Osmondale Ivanhoe. And Ivanhoe is one of the foundation sires of the Holstein breed. So my father and his little dirt farmer in Rhode Island became known all over the world for his bull. And still, if you know anything about the history of the Holstein breed, mm-hmm. you know the bull. And you may not know my father's relationship to him, but he came to our house and his calves and his daughters were really what sold that bull to the world.
Okay.
So he is, my dad was a very humble man, but he was a savant in his own way. This is one thing he knew, and he became the best at what he did. He's one of the only people I've ever met who actually became the best at whatever his field was.
Wow.
So, I happened to spend a lot of time with him. I always just wanted to be with him. And because I grew up on a farm, that was sort of built in.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's the story of where his love of the animals came from. And I was inspired by that. But he was also my dad.
Right. And that's, it's a combination of you wanted to follow in his footsteps with taking care of the animals because of your relationship with him, but also because you were on the farm and that was an expectation.
Right.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it is, it's in you, it's innate,
right?
Right? You don't know when you learn certain things, you just know certain things. Mm-hmm. And it was my dad's idea for me to join 4-H. I was shy, I was a quiet kid, and I didn't want to. And it was tough for me in the beginning. And then I met some really wonderful people, some of whom you've met today.
Yeah.
And it changed my life. And so I was able to do something that my dad loved, but I made my own thing from it as well.
Yeah.
And it was a bond that we had. And my mother wasn't particularly interested in the cows. And my siblings, they did a lot of work on the farm, but they weren't interested in showing. So this was something that I shared with him.
And 4-H is how you got into the showing aspect.
I showed with my dad on fairs, just his cows with him and other adults. But this was the time, this was a great meeting of that life with also other kids my age. And that was really important.
So how long, as far as your age, like how long were you showing cows?
I went in the ring the first time when I was 6 years old. Mm-hmm. My dad stood outside the ring for a couple of years.
Wow.
Because I saw some six-year-olds go in today and they got to bring little calves. I did not get to bring a little calf. My dad wasn't known for showing his calves. He was known for showing his older animals. So I went in with a senior yearling, so she probably would have been about 900 pounds at the time. And my mother was a town girl. She was terrified. But my father's like, she'll be fine.
Yeah.
She'll be fine. And, you know, I was.
Yeah.
So I did that until I was about 11. And then I started showing with 4-H.
Okay.
And so I would do 5 fairs through the course of the season.
Wow.
Including the Washington County Fair, Rocky Hill Fair in Rhode Island. All of my fairs were in Rhode Island except one, which is in North Stonington. And then all of us went to the Big E in West Springfield, Massachusetts in September.
Wow. And you had been talking about that being kind of the week away, you know, like the sleepaway camp.
Yeah.
With 4-H. So that's 5 weeks of sleepaway camp, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Some were only long weekends. But we just, like I said, we got dropped off. The boys slept in bunkhouses right on the fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. And the girls, we either stayed at somebody's house. You know, we all got in the back of a pickup and we got dropped off at somebody's house. One time we stayed in a camper on the grounds, wherever some parent would actually make sure we were in for the night.
Yes.
That's where we went. You know, I don't know what we lived on. Del's Lemonade, definitely Del's. And, you know, maybe some French fries and that's about it.
Yeah. Any memorable experiences that stand out from that time?
From the fairs?
From the fairs and 4-H fairs, specifically thinking about that.
You know, I think what we did was we figured out how to spend our days. And, yeah. Remembering that we had live animals in our care, and mm-hmm. we were expected to be responsible for those. We were responsible for those animals. There was no adult looking over our shoulder. But we did things, depending on the fair, we showed in Newport, and we jumped off this pier into the Saconnet River. And when we were at one fair, there was a trailer full of hay, and we did hay wrestling because those were the days of the big, like Andre the Giant and all those. I didn't know any of these wrestlers, but the boys did, and so yeah. they would teach us these wrestling moves. We would always find an empty field to play football or softball in. We would troll around the Midway, of course. We went to the concerts at night. So we partook in the fair life, but we also partook in the just normal life of right. teenagers. And we spent a lot of time just hanging out in the bunkhouse, talking and laughing.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we didn't have phones. We didn't have any contact with our parents. You would never go to a payphone and call your parents unless it was like a bone protruding through your leg. Yes. There was no reason to call your parents. So we just kind of bonded. And we didn't fight. Mm-hmm. We didn't, you know, from what I remember, it was all very sweet and funny and,
yeah.
And I think that's tested when I see the kids I was in 4-H with 45, however many years it's been, mm-hmm. years ago. We all have the same feeling like, oh my gosh, thank God we did that. We were so lucky.
Yeah. You know? And it's like you were, I mean, I don't want to minimize it to say work colleagues, but you had the animals and like the work that was kind of the thing that brought you all together. And you were also, you know, just kids, but had to be responsible kids for these animals. And
yeah.
so that's kind of thinking about like the summer camp experience. You know, I keep going back to that, trying to find a corollary for myself. And like, I know the trouble that my niece and nephew do in summer camp, to say nothing of my own children. but it seems like it was that we have a job to do. We're going to have a wonderful time together,
yeah.
but also we have this job that's very important.
Yeah. And you know what I think that did for me as a kid mm-hmm. who couldn't make small talk very easily, I could talk about cows and, you know, the work was what we did together first.
Yeah.
And so that was the icebreaker.
Yes.
And after that, you know, as you're doing the work, you begin to have these conversations and part of them comes out of this thing that we share. And then you begin to know about these other kids and their different lives. A huge percentage of the kids I was in 4-H with were not farm kids. Mm-hmm. They were kids who lived in the neighborhood where there was a farm.
Right.
And so if people know about Escobar's farm in Portsmouth, for example, there was a whole street full of kids who just hung out. They call themselves Esky's crew, and they hung out with Louis Escobar and his farm, and he taught them about 4-H. And then these kids who wouldn't have anything to do, have had anything to do with cows, ended up at the fair with us. So,
yeah.
you know, again, it would have been very hard to just step into a room full of those kids, say at a junior high dance and talk to them.
Yeah.
But at the fairs, when we were dividing up chores and we had these shared interests, that just gave us a base from which to grow. And some of them were so social, they didn't need it, but I did.
I mean, my oldest, who's 12 now, has been wanting to do something like 4-H because, you know, we see the kids at the local one. This is up in Mass, but just we see the kids taking that level of ownership and pride in the work mm-hmm. and that you had talked about confidence, like the confidence that builds.
Right.
Because, you know, because you have this to ground you, basically.
And you can control a very large animal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see to the needs of that animal largely on your own.
Right.
I mean, I have children. We have 3 cats and we have 2 dogs and we've had all kinds of pets in our house. And
yeah.
my husband and I do probably 96% of
yeah,
the care,
right?
And I don't know, you know, I have to leave instructions when I go away about how to feed the cat or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case with us. It's not the case with farm kids.
Right.
You know, we have to be part of the work. And
yeah.
we were, those of us who were from farms were from small family farms.
Yeah.
It was our parents and it was us. And
yeah.
That was it.
So thinking about, you know, our average listener probably has very little contact with or understanding with like, you know, farming and farm life. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you have any, aside from reading your book, any other like books or things that come to mind to just sort of get a sense of what it's really like.
I have not read another book entirely about dairy farming.
Okay.
And dairy farming is very different. And we talked a little about this because cows, no matter what, have to be milked twice a day.
Right.
So Christmas morning, they have to be milked. And when we had the blizzard of 78, the cows had to be milked. And yeah. you might have to milk them by hand, but you have to get the milk out of them.
Right.
So that sets up a very different world. I mean, I read a book when I was a kid, my favorite book. Well, of course, I read Charlotte's Web.
Yeah.
And that was a farm, but a different kind of farm. My mother actually had to take Charlotte's Web away from me because that's the only book I would read. And I read it and read it and read it. And finally, she's like, let's try something else.
Yeah.
And then my second favorite book was a book by Robert Newton Peck called The Day No Pigs Would Die. And in that book, in the first scene, there's a Holstein cow who is trying to deliver her calves and she can't. And this kid, my age, finds her in the pasture. It's his neighbor's cow. Mm-hmm. And he helps her deliver these twin bull calves. And I thought, oh my God, that is my life.
Right.
And I had never seen it anywhere. And the book wasn't necessarily about those cows and dairy farming, but at least it had that sort of lead in. So I'm so thrilled that the kids that I knew in 4-H and other dairy farmers that I've heard from across the country now have read the book and have responded to it.
Yeah.
But I have also heard from people who say, I'm a city girl and I loved this book. I had no idea this was what life was like. I was a farm kid, but I was a kid, like I said, I was kind of a loner. I was trying to fit in. I felt like an outsider. I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a love story about that way of life and a love story about my relationship with my father. And I think that's something other people can relate to as well. So
yes.
I wish I could say specifically, oh, so-and-so's book is about dairy farming. Read that. But the books I've read mostly about farming have been about people now realizing that locally grown and produced food is important.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave their life in the city and they go to Vermont and they start this, you know, vegetable farm or they start farming. I wish I could remember the names of these, but I read another memoir about a woman who lives in Oakland, California, and she found a vacant lot and she raised pigs and everything else on this vacant lot, you know, so that she could grow food in the city.
Yeah.
Again, that's a very different experience than dairy farming on a small family farm.
Right. Is it different just because of the, like, having to milk and having that kind of, like, I have to do these two times, just that kind of clock?
Yes.
Yeah.
The milking.
Yeah. Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Because there, you know, if you, I have a friend who's a vegetable farmer and, you know, he pretty much does work all year, but he has slower months.
Sure.
You don't have that when you're dairy farming.
Yeah. Maybe to give people a sense of the book, is there any story or vignette that you would want to share just to give people an understanding of the kinds of stories that they'll find?
Well, I'll give you a story about maybe what's sort of unique about being a farm kid. So I just retired. I was an English teacher at high school level for 27 years. And we were at a faculty meeting and we had an icebreaker and my principal wanted us to turn to the person next to us and talk about a moment of failure that we had.
Okay.
And the woman next to me said, okay, I failed my permit test. And I said, oh, well, I once had to shove a garden hose down a cow's throat to keep her from choking and she didn't make it. And she said, so you intubated a cow. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
I was 16 years old and I was doing this via landline talking to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you think about that story, that's what it's like to grow up on a farm and be a kid on a farm. And so there is some of that in here. There's some of those kinds of stories in here. I mean, there's some humor in the book as well,
mm-hmm.
but we are dealing with live animals. And
right.
so there is some stuff to maybe know about and brace yourself for.
Yeah. Is there anything else that I haven't thought to ask that you would want to make sure to share with people, either about your book or yourself?
I think, so I'm a short story writer and a poet. And mm-hmm. those, I have other books. I have two books of poetry and a book of short stories. I didn't intend to write a memoir.
Yeah.
Whenever you're writing, well, I won't speak for all writers, but for me, I never really think about who's going to read this ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And with a memoir, the stakes are so high. So it was a very different book to put out into the public because my sisters are in the book and their husbands are in the book. My parents are both deceased. Some of our hired hands are in the book. The boy I had a crush on all of my life is in the book. and everybody is reading it.
Yeah.
And so that's been very different for me. I hope I never write another memoir. I'm glad I wrote this one. If I could only have published one book in my life, this would have been the book I wanted to publish. But it was a little bit of a nerve-wracking experience.
Sure.
This is the only book I've written where, like, a high school friend of mine showed up to take me out to dinner one night, and she had all of these Post-its in it. And she's like, okay, I want to know who Jimmy Riga is, and I want to know. And I was like, wow, this is just, you can't, as a fiction writer, you can sort of cop out and go, oh, no, I made that up. You know what I mean?
But you can't do that when you're calling it a memoir. And it sounds like you changed some names. And, you know, so it's kind of like, who is this person really?
Right. Yes, I did change names, and a couple of people are sort of composite people. But when people know your story and they sit down with you with this book, it's like, oh, right, everybody does have a stake in this.
Right.
And that's very different and something I hope I treated with care.
Yes. Well, I know, speaking as an Ohio transplant, I think there's nothing more true than the, like, 3 degrees of separation for Rhode Island. And now that I've been here long enough that it's like, I feel that happening to myself for, like, oh, I know that person. It's like, or, oh, you know, you really shouldn't have done that because I know that person.
You know? Oh, I grew up in a town full of Calabrese, which is what my mother's family is. And, you know, anytime you even wanted to date somebody, you had to go home and check with your mother and the family tree, right? Because it's a small town and we came from a small section of Italy and you just had to be careful. So it's true. I mean, you just don't know. Like, my publisher got a call from somebody in Florida who had read about the book in one of the Breed magazines. And he said, I have to get a copy of that book. I worked on that farm. I knew that family. I knew that bull. I used that bull. And I need a copy of that book. I need to see what she wrote.
Oh, no.
You know, so it's been very interesting to hear how things are received.
Yeah. So, of course, Barnflower is available at your local public library here in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Where else can people find and get in touch with the book?
So the book was published by Loom Press, which is a small press that's been in business for over 30 years in Amesbury, Massachusetts. You can get it directly from the publishers. It's on major online booksellers as well. Yep. And I'll be all over.
Yeah. Yeah, you're on book tour right now.
Absolutely. I'm on a self-produced book tour. And my three sisters, Barbara Ann, Jeannie, and Patty, show up. They're my roadies. They always bring food. So if they're there, you know, you're going to eat.
Any upcoming stops that you want people to look out for?
I'm going to be in Ipswich the first Saturday in October. They have a book festival going on there, Ipswich, Mass. The next day, I'm going to be in Connecticut at Fort Hills Farm.
Wow.
So they have a dairy farm, but they also have diversified, which many dairy farms have. And they have, I think it's apple picking that's there and some other stuff going on. I'm going to be at the University of Vermont in October. I'm going to be meeting with some ag students and some Vermont farmers. Well, that's what I can think of at the top of my head.
Yeah, that's, I mean, 3 states right there in a weekend,
know.
Huh?
I know. It's been great. I you know, it's a dream come true. So I'm good. I'm zero complaints.
Fantastic. Well, Carla, I really appreciate so much of your time today. It's been a delight for me. And, you know, I hope everyone picks up the book and is equally delighted. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening. Barnflower is available now from Loom Press and at an Ocean State Library near you. Also, Carla will be at the Cranston Public Library on Saturday, October 14th at 3:00 p.m. Visit cranstonlibrary.org/events for more info about this event. I'll also put links in the show notes. I'd like to extend a huge thank you to the Washington County Fair and Clark Memorial Library for hosting, and especially to Carla Pansiera for taking the time to walk me through the fair. It was a wonderful experience, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Rhodey Radio is proud to be a resident partner of the Rhode Island Center for the Book and is brought to you by library staff and community members all around the Ocean State. Rhodey Radio is made possible with support from the Office of Library and Information Services. The project has been funded in part by grants from the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the American Library Association. You can find more from Rhodey Radio on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you enjoyed today's episode, subscribe to Rhodey Radio and rate or review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to help us reach more Rhode Islanders. Thanks again for listening.